Y esta derrota es una dura lección a los agentes, lacayos y herramientas de Estados Unidos a nivel regional y mundial.
De acuerdo a analistas, los afganos confiaron en los estadounidenses y fueron abandonados, una realidad que los pueblos de Oriente Medio afirman debería servir de lección a los gobiernos árabes sumisos a la voluntad de la Casa Blanca, así como a la gente que vincula el destino de sus países y de sus pueblos con Estados Unidos, incluidas las llamadas fuerzas democráticas sirias que, además de apoyar la ocupación estadounidense a suelo sirio, secundan el saqueo de Washington a los recursos energéticos y agrícolas de Siria.
Estados Unidos siempre busca defender sus intereses y en el momento que estima adecuado. Abandona a sus herramientas luego de cumplir su tarea en contra de los intereses de sus propios países y por ello en el caso de Siria. Las llamadas fuerzas democráticas sirias desplegadas en el norte del país deben aprender la lección y volver al seno de la patria antes de ser abandonadas por sus amos estadounidenses.
La actual situación de Estados Unidos hacia el gobierno de Afganistán constituye un claro mensaje a todos aquellos gobiernos árabes que confían en Estados Unidos de que es posible abandonarlos y dejar de defenderlos cuando sea necesario. Y por ello estos gobiernos deben tomar lección de lo ocurrido en Afganistán y entender bien que no pueden confiar en Estados Unidos para proteger su seguridad y defender su permanencia en el poder.
La situación ha infundido ánimos en aquellos que desean ver a los norteamericanos fuera de Oriente Medio. Los ataques de la resistencia popular tanto en Siria como en Irak se incrementaron esta última semana contra las ilegales bases militares estadounidenses en ambos países. Hisham Onus, Telesur, Oriente Medio.
En Brasil, mientras en la última década disminuyeron los homicidios entre la población en general, aumentaron los asesinatos de indígenas. El corresponsal de Telesur en Brasil, André Vieira, también reporta sobre un aumento de la ocupación de tierras de estas comunidades que actualmente protestan contra las demarcaciones de las tierras.
El número de asesinatos de los pueblos indígenas, de personas que son indígenas aquí en Brasil, aumentó 21,6%. Esto en 10 años. Fueron 2.074 indígenas asesinados durante este periodo de tiempo. Esto es un número alarmante aquí para Brasil, una vez que esto viene en la contramano de los crímenes de la sociedad en general aquí en Brasil, de los asesinatos en general aquí en Brasil, que en general Brasil disminuyó 10,3% el número de asesinatos, mientras que los indígenas fueron más de 20% de aumento en el número de asesinatos contra los pueblos indígenas aquí en Brasil. Este dato viene también en un momento que se sabe, por ejemplo, que hubo un aumento también de la invasión de tierras por parte de la minería artesanal ilegal aquí en Brasil. Por ejemplo, durante 10 años, de 2010 hasta 2020, aumentó un 495% la ocupación de tierras indígenas por parte de la minería irregular, esta minería artesanal, mientras que por otro lado también aumentó el número más de 300% de la ocupación de tierras por parte de esa minería en las áreas protegidas aquí de Brasil. Un número alarmante para estos pueblos que están movilizados en Brasilia, en la principal movilización de los últimos tiempos, de todos los tiempos de los indígenas. Ellos están movilizados en Brasilia en el campamento Lucha por la Tierra para impedir el avance de pautas antiindígenas en el Congreso y también en la Suprema Corte. Y el día de mañana es un día fundamental para los pueblos indígenas, una vez que la Suprema Corte retomará el debate que determinará las demarcaciones de tierras aquí en Brasil, que establecerá o no un marco temporal para la lucha, para la reivindicación de las tierras indígenas por parte de estos pueblos. Así que el día de mañana un día muy importante frente a todo este retroceso de violencia y también de ocupación ilegal de las tierras indígenas aquí en Brasil.
Y así llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre de Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President Daniel Ortega's said.
And coming up next on the stream of freakradio.org, also at the Huff website, sometimes a more convenient spot for all of you folks who get up later than I do. It's the September 2nd, 2021 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Going to have lots of interviews, a short show, but hopefully, I don't know, an active one. We're covering the latest from Food Now Bomb's celebration, where the Union of the Homeless is heading for Sacramento for a mass freedom ride from different parts of the state. And we also got various updates from the Benchlands and other goodies besides. So hang with us and you'll find out.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to kick this off with a rather lengthy interview with Kevin, who, if you've ever visited the Benchlands encampment, you will have seen either him or some of his residents, some of whom are chickens, some of whom are dogs, and some of whom are goats. And they can be found right next to the, actually the courthouse, right below the courthouse in the Benchlands area near the courthouse. And Kevin's a regular attender to the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting, which meets every Thursday at 11 o'clock. And we sit around and jabber a bit and wonder what we could do, if we could do anything. And who knows, someday maybe we will. But Kevin has been living in encampments for a long time. And he's lived in this encampment for quite a while. And he's sort of evolved some reflections that I think are really quite striking and interesting, and I don't always agree with him. That's not the point, though. The point is, this is his experience, and I'm going to be playing some of this now. Well, today is August 31st, 2021. I'm here about 20 to 12 talking with
Kevin from Heaven.
Yes, notorious heaven-bound Kevin, or perhaps he's in heaven now. I'm not sure. But not what you said.
The kingdom of heaven is upon us.
I see. And,
it's not a place. It's a set of laws.
And the goats are keeping a watch.
Yeah, they're good goats. They make a lot of people happy.
So you told me things are all is not well in heavenland.
The biggest problem that we have as homeless people in this camp particularly, and we all admit it, Janelle just admitted it, is we can't organize even a little bit. And I have tried for an entire year to assemble 6 to 8 people, because that's what a camp, that's the size a camp needs to be. So one or two people can always be on security, and the other 6 can be about their business. But if we set it up tribe-like or family-like, then, you know, maybe one of those people can be procuring the food for 7 people. You know, or, and I think it would, I've done the math, because I know how to do time studies, and I ran construction crews, and I predicted times it would take me to get projects done and deliver them on time and on budget, and I think I still have those skills, but I haven't been able to apply them. But, it would only take 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, with weekends almost completely free for everyone. What needs to happen to organize this mess. I am not in control of my days or my life, even in the slightest. I wake up to a problem, and it just goes one meeting after another throughout the day. Today we had the police and fire department here telling us we own too much stuff, you know.
You tell them they get their budget is too big as well.
No, Justin said it perfectly. Justin was like, oh, really? How many things do you own?
Mm-hmm.
Built 2 friggin' houses with my own 2 hands, and then had somebody come along and say, oh, no, you can't own these houses that you built because of total fucking fraud.
So what was their purpose, just telling people to eliminate their stuff? Were they suggesting they were going to be moving on people?
No, none of that yet. Just all the, you got too much stuff. You're taking up too much space. We haven't complained before. Now we're starting to complain. We haven't really written you a formal ticket, but we might. Well, yeah, it's just all over the map. Everything is all over the map.
Any changes in the population here?
Constant, you know, with people passing away and moving around. And that's one of the things they tried to say, is that, well, you take up too much space, you're taking it from someone else. But they're not realizing that, or giving us credit, for what we do here, which is, you know, accepting donations and passing out food and helping people keep their devices charged. And, oh, we're not allowed to have a generator. You know how much time and effort and money went into, you know, collecting that and operating it and providing it for everyone? And they tell us we can't even do that.
And is this the first time they've come to you with this concern? Or?
No, that's been a repetitive one because we're obviously extended beyond our 12 by 12 area. We're supposed to each get a 12 by 12 area.
Interesting.
And that's the other thing that aggravates me. You know, they see the bicycle chop shops, you know, just because they like the rhyme to it and just like they like to feel cool about, you know. What the fuck is that? That's calling a impoverished person's cottage industry that actually provides something useful to his neighbors, you know, repaired and operational bicycles. And, oh, that's called a criminal enterprise?
Well, it's these dirty homeless people that are doing it, man.
Oh, yeah, dirty, stinky, gross homeless people that just want to steal things, you know? It's...
I have a better chess. Actually, I do have a better chess set here. Kevin and I are playing chess while we discuss life, and also I brought some flyers, which I had. Of course, next time I'll be bringing a table that we can put the flyers on.
Terry, blocking this. How are you doing today?
Sorry, I don't know. I would just say that, you know, I'm thankful for all those people who have helped and brought food. And we're holding strong. I look forward to the future, and I hope that we can kind of get, like, you know, a soup kitchen where indoors this has open windows to the outdoors so that we can supply food easier, more frequently, like 24/7 is what I'm hoping for right here, you know, like a... You know, even if we got multiple numbers, three or four would do this town really well. I know a lot of towns, one per town should be normal. And I know a lot of people who worked in schools and or government programs that need jobs. And the government pays for those jobs. So wherever Food Not Bombs, man, thrive on, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Everybody loves chives on top of their mashed potato. Especially bacon.
And what is your name, madam?
I'm Katie Bradley.
And Katie, how long have you been here?
I've been here almost a year.
In this camp or generally?
In this camp, yeah.
How has it changed, if at all? What are your thoughts about it?
It's dwindled a little bit. There was two different big campsites, and for a minute it was like I wasn't able to get to one of them, you know. It grew really big for a while, and people disappear and people reappear. We try and go back home to our families, and we come back to a place where we knew there was food. Santa Cruz is holding up with the food, and it's supplying the people a living life. So,
What do you think? You already mentioned one of the things you think needs to be gotten, which is a more suitable food source, a more reliable food source.
Just a building that's indoor and outdoor that has open windows, huge open windows that we can provide food out of. It doesn't have to be anything but a kitchen. Just as long as it's a kitchen that has windows to the outdoors, we'd do much better as Food Not Bombs.
Yeah, like another Food Not Bombs, maybe with a generator and, you know, some skillets, and we can almost, you know, prepare and serve the food.
Yeah. What you're saying, what you said right there, what I picked up real quickly, sorry to stop you, but was something that is more outdoorsy, like for a woodsman, like, you know, where we have fire pits and maybe outside ovens, because I know that they do, like with the Rainbow Tribe, they do these huge stone ovens outdoors. And they bake bread, and they bake, yeah, pizza, exactly, pies and stuff like that. So that's
a Kendall those.
We can do those here on this land.
It's all labor. It's not even material. Gather stone, build a brick oven. Just give us permission to do something cool.
That's already been allotted, I believe, because I was a part of the committee in the beginning that helped found the start of it. but I was separated and became homeless. I mean, I was military beforehand, and so, like, yeah, I mean, we were a family, military family that came. We drove from Colorado, and we brought food and supplies for this program. We brought Bunsen burners and ovens and all kinds of stuff, you know, for the people that might be out here. I mean, we spent just my family, we spent at least $20,000 for the people that were out here. And each one of our friends kind of spent the same thing, and then they had the government program. But we haven't, to be honest, we haven't received all of that we've spent, just of my knowledge. So, I'm trying to check in on it, but I've had trouble with my phones and getting a hold of the contacts that I knew when I was...
It's Katie, is it?
Yeah, Katie Bradley.
Katie, what's your opinion of the Dakota Landing Camp, the campus, and the fenced off beyond the bridge?
I think it's good probably to have a fenced off area where people want to be inside of a fence. It gives them a little bit more secure feeling, you know. And actually, we've talked about doing age groups for camp areas. It works better for dating. It works better for singles. It works better for children if there's a, you know, when children have their own area and then they meet their parents afterwards. Usually they enjoy it quite a bit. But there are things like the Narcan or overdosing where a parent could lose its child. That is to be wary about while talking age groups and fencing.
How many children would you say are in the camp?
Honestly, to be honest, I've only seen like one child, maybe two. There's a couple teenagers.
Three actually.
I think there's more children trying to come back to life. I mean, I believe in reincarnation. I've died, and I've come back to life myself. So it depends on your belief systems. If you've died before, then you'll understand what I said right there. If you haven't, or if you have no recollection of dying and living again, then the story's different for you, and you need something else or somebody else to speak with for you.
How have the police been treating the camp?
The police have been really kind. They do like us to keep our yards really tidy, and if we stray away from each other, they want to pull us out. And they'll arrest us if we get, you know, if we get to jump in too fast off the bridge or something. So they're holding their part. The police seem to be doing a really good job.
Kevin, your thoughts?
Yeah, the police don't bother me. I have a kind of a different attitude about it.
How are things going? How are things going with you and getting your herd with the goats? Are you
working so hard on it, but getting frustrated and a little disappointed that it isn't making progress, like our lawn bowler thing, you know? And that's something that never got picked up on.
And remind those of this.
Such a metaphor.
Remind those who have forgotten what that was, Kevin.
When I first got here and I first camped out near the lawn bowlers, I came up with this great idea to build bridges between normies and hobos, and we were going to have the lawn bowling tournament of death. And we were going to have Katie signed up. I had about 14 people sign up before I even really started to announce it. I did this beautiful write-up for it that was humorous and interesting. And I put my, yeah, you remember that, right?
Yeah, lawn bowling.
Yeah.
And I had my... I think it was before I came back on the second time, because the first time I came, I was with my family, and then the second time I came, I was divorced and I didn't have my children with me. So, you know, I'm looking for my family. There's pieces of my family missing, but lawn bowling, like I heard you were saying something about having 500 goats and doing...
Oh, yeah, that's my other plan, and it could be a cure to home, even though the deal with the lawn bowlers wasn't, you know, but this is how it goes all over the map, that's, you know what I mean? Because that story was months ago, Well, we had, I promoted the whole thing and had my $132 to sign up to be a member.
The lawn bowlers are sort of an elderly group who use the park before there was a use of it for homeless emergency shelter, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And they were disgusted by the homeless people, but, you know, I was...
Huh?
Those people had paid to be a part of a specific group. They weren't looking forward to having a homeless community right in their area where they were going to play.
Exactly. However, the city paid for their lawn bowling green, $10,000 for that plastic grass, so that they can leave the houses that they're lucky enough to live in to come down to our spot where we're homeless to play their stupid game in front of us?
I know.
All right. I didn't cop. Hold on, Katie. Okay, I didn't cop an attitude about that. Instead, I said the opposite. Instead, I said, yeah, you're welcome, and hey, let's play together.
And what was their reaction?
They were like, yeah, what could they say? You know, and then they were leading me to believe that this would happen. And
did they sign up for it? Or?
Well, let me tell you the story, because it's always convoluted. Because they didn't say, no, we don't want to bowl with you. You're homeless. They didn't say that till 6 weeks later, after I landscaped all around. Me and Manny Santos landscaped all around their bowling green. I even went in there and cleaned up a mess that somebody had made and vandalized that they told
me
not to.
Sure. I know that we're looking forward to having Drag Queens of America here. It's a big show where we do like... you know, like a red velvet rope, like carpet that they walk on or something. I'm not sure exactly what they have planned, but some sort of runway where we walk over the pond with our drag queens, and which is why it's labeled San Lorenzo, because our favorite drag queen ever is a Hispanic male, and he's from California. And I was hoping to actually get to be one of them. Violet, a friend of mine, she used to be a drag queen. I was one of the overweight ones.
No, buxom. But let me finish what this lawn bowling thing was.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Oh. I'm headed out, so thank you so much. What was your name, sir?
I'm Robert.
And your last name?
Norse.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, thank you, Katie.
Mr. Norse.
Yeah, and he does a good job organizing all our stories.
Well, I said, if you get any babies, I want a baby, you know.
Well, I want you in one of my camps when I get to the Firewise camp. If that project's successful,
and if you do,
you're in.
If you get movement on your free range, let me know, because I'm in on your free range movement.
Exactly. That's what we're doing.
Thanks, Katie.
See you, Katie.
So again, you spruced.
So I got strong. Yeah. So did that because the woman who I thought was the president of the league had said, well, you know, it's not just the fee. We also do maintenance to the lawn bowling green. I'm like, oh, great. Well, I'll get busy with the maintenance because I love throwing a shovel. And I did that. And she even appreciated what I did. It was 100 hours of landscaping work. Mm. You know, it was substantial. Every week, about 4 weeks in a row, hey, sign me up, sign me up, sign me up. Oh, well, this, oh, well, that. And then I started to get the hint that, yeah, they're dragging their feet, hoping I forget about the whole thing. So I led them to my article, and I tried to pin them down to say, no, let's do this. And then finally David came out and said, we don't trust you people with our equipment. Oh, so you're saying we can't play with you. So, yeah. And then
when was that?
When was this? This was all around. This is going back to like February and March.
This was almost before this was set up here in the Bay.
Oh, it was before this was set up, and I was living up there before they moved us down here.
Mm-hmm.
It all happened, you know, from start to you know, from goodwill and offering a hand of friendship to getting that hand spat on and made a fool out of.
The city council has had two meetings, and actually today it is having another meeting, which is a study session to... from my perspective, to set in concrete the reactionary majority that's on city council by making it district elections, so that every district does its own voting. No, don't eat those pieces. You bad goat. Or you hungry goat. So you yourself have put out a proposal for the... can't read your sign. Rancho...
Yeah, Rancho Mascota.
Having to do with goats and other animals as a productive approach to dealing with homeless survival. Is that fair to say?
Oh, it solves multiple problems at once. And it makes so much sense that I don't think anybody's going to go for it. Because it makes sense.
A little too sensible, in other words.
Too sensible, exactly. And requires action.
Well, maybe you could invade Monterey County with armed weapons. Or I guess you'd have to have armed weapons. You know, I mean, the troops in Afghanistan need something to do now that some of them are leaving. So, no, I'm just saying that would be a little more nonsensical, and that might get some traction.
It's just, who do you get an audience with? Who do you present it to? And then who says, okay, you know, I used to be a general contractor, so this isn't a mystery to me. I know how they put out proposals. I know how they do this, but that was 20 years ago. It seems like they do things differently now, or maybe they do things differently in California, or I don't know. But I know that herds of goats cleaning fuel off the forest floors in California reduces property damage.
I think I've read about that as well, even more recently.
This isn't something I've invented. This is something that's already proven. So now something I could do is scale it, make that happen on a big enough scale so that we're getting thousands of acres cleared of fuel that spreads wildfires. Now, instead of having a 2 herders to 400 goat ratio, we have about a 7 to 22 person to goat ratio, so that we can place not just all the homeless people, but the people that are in overpriced apartments getting ripped off by their bosses and landlords, where they may as well be in jail for the amount of time they have to put in for their food and shelter and medicine.
And now I'm going to get back to this chess game, I think, which we began.
I can't tell the difference between the colors of the pieces.
And that is a problem.
Really,
so we're going to work on that.
But as the chess game continues, there will also be continued dialogue. And I will also kind of intersperse this with some just general commentary. Here's a story from Mountain View, which I noticed, I guess it was a couple days ago, a Monday, August 30th, city seeks dismissal of parking ban suit. There's not a lot that I want to comment on this article on, but the main point is that people in RVs who are essentially using them as survival shelter are being attacked by the aesthetic property value profiteers or privileged folks who just can't stand these unsightly RVs and are creating this pretext that, oh, these RVs are oversized vehicles and they cause a problem because you can't see them and they cause a traffic hazard. Well, you can hear the skepticism in my voice. I saw this kind of crappy argument that was used. It's really an argument that says we don't want the damn homeless people cluttering up our streets and our parking places. I saw it used in Palo Alto to create a so-called trip and fall law in 1997, 98, thereabouts. And they just didn't have the statistics to do it, but I think they, I don't remember if they actually modified the law, didn't do it, but we've certainly put up, some of us from different parts of the Bay Area and also Santa Cruz, put up quite a fuss. But there is this same thing is happening in Mountain View. It's being brought, there's a lawsuit being brought to stop this ordinance, which I guess was ratified by a vote of the people, sadly enough, that essentially prohibits RVs from parking on most city streets. And those who are suing are saying that it's unconstitutional, inhumane, burdens the growing group of people who have chosen to live in vehicles on the street amid a dire affordability crisis that has priced them out of the areas they know as home. And the city is doing this, is pushing these laws, responds that, oh, it's not really targeting the poorest residents. Rather, they're simply improving traffic safety, and they have made great strides in building affordable housing for low-income residents and have provided safer alternatives for people living in RVs, like its 101-space safe parking zone. If we continue looking at the story, however, we find there is no description of the number of RVs that will be displaced and the number of homeless people that will be made homeless in the sense that if they try to park and they start getting tickets, they may find what Santa Cruz people are finding, their vehicles getting towed away. You're going to hear some of that in some of the interviews later in the show here from Santa Cruz. The history of this is the lawsuit comes 3 years after the city adopted an ordinance banning oversized vehicles and RVs from 444 of the city's 525 streets. Amid pushback from the city's fair housing proponents, the ordinance was temporarily suspended after a successful petition forced the ordinance on the November 2020 ballot as Measure C. And with about 57% of the vote in favor, Mountain View residents passed the ballot measure in November as okaying discrimination and banning of RVs on most of the city streets. And the city then moved to swiftly enforce the ban by the summer of 2021. The first no parking signs are already going up in the city's northwest side at the cost of nearly $1 million, and the residents have expressed fears of being displaced. Though the RV ban prohibits oversized vehicles from 83% of the city's streets, another ban on parking oversized vehicles in streets with bike lanes makes it about 90% of Mountain View streets are unavailable to RV residents. And this was being done, the people doing the lawsuit say, under the pretext of traffic safety to expel the indigent population after years of increased enforcement of parking laws that target the city's vehicular residents. Oversized vehicles may continue, however, the city responds, to park on streets wider than 40 feet, streets without bicycle lanes, and in the 5 safe parking lots the city has established to provide safer alternatives for its unhoused population. It's also published in advance what streets you can rush to and hide in before they, of course, start eliminating parking there, as well as Santa Cruz has done with its permit parking laws. And nowhere in this RV story in the Mercury News, city seeks dismissal of parking ban sued by Aldo Toledo. Again, as I said before, is there any indication of how many people are actually impacted by this? What actual traffic hazards have been substantially documented that would justify such an ordinance? And so this is more protective cover for bigots who want to drive away folks whose class status they don't like. Let's have a musical break, and we'll get back to a man I call Kevin of the Goats.
Wake up another morning, see my baby's cheeks. Glad to be around to have another week. Watch the magic happen, find all there is to learn as the planet floods and burns. Wake up another morning, grind some coffee beans, turn on Al Jazeera, marvel at the scenes. Towns reduced to ashes while the twisters turn as the planet floods and burns. Wake up another morning, picking on these strings. One more day to be here, find out what life brings. The horizon's red and easy, that much I can discern as the planet floods and burns. Wake up another morning, watch the neighbor's driveway, heading to a warehouse to work another day, leaving me to wonder how fast this wind can churn as the planet floods and burns. Wake up another morning, see the Twitter trolls complain about the fascists who are living on the dole, demanding safe space in the boxcar and other such concerns as the planet floods and burns. wake up another morning, see the orange hue. Know what needs to happen, don't know what to do. Show me to the ark, where's the balance stern, as the planet floods and burns. Wake up another morning, in the now again. If I want to see the future, I can count to ten. History, you'll find it in the tombstones and the urns, as the planet floods and burns.
Sometimes it's just punching somebody.
So, Kevin, you say that you're hopeful of kind of organizing the camp if and when you ever can and get enough people together to do it. But one of the things I mentioned that Panther of the Dakota Landing Camp, the I guess it's the community agreement camp that's fenced in on the other side of the bridge, describes himself, or I believe he did to me, as a bouncer. And you were pointing out that there's a difference between being a pacifist and believing in, you know, using all means short of violent, destruction of a person. Right.
That's the difference. I consider myself a peacemaker. I couldn't call myself a Christian if I didn't value making peace. And I abhor violence and war and death and maiming people. However, some pacifists take it too far and don't distinguish between what I call brotherly brawling or a bouncer's use of non-deadly force as another category. It can't be put in the same category as murder and mayhem.
Such as, let's say, a chokehold or taking someone down physically when they are being violent or threatening someone else?
Well, it's like Jane just spoke about. You're going to have a problem that will always, it always start out verbally, and then that, because of misunderstandings or what have you, that can escalate. Now, Washington State is the only state in this country where two people, two grown adults, can say, let's fight. Okay, your offense has gone beyond anything I want to talk about anymore, okay? You're going to tell me I fuck my goats? No, I'm not having a discussion with you about that. I'm going to punch you in the face now. Put up your dukes, you know? And in Washington State, I can call a police officer over and say, please referee this fight, and he will. And as long as you follow certain rules, you don't gouge their eye out or do something purposefully to maim them or injure them in a major way, it's considered not a crime. And I don't think that should be considered violence.
Have you actually seen this process happen in Washington State?
No, that's where I was heading when I accidentally ended up here. But now in California, it's still, in most other states, you can still have a fight by agreement, and it's really only a misdemeanor. It's not an assault, as long as there's enough witnesses to say, yeah, these guys agreed to fight. It's a mutual affray, as they call in Vermont. But that's one of the problems with our country, is you got to be a lawyer just to cross state borders. I mean, the laws change so drastically from place to place, you don't know when you're in your rights or when you're not. So that's all I'm proposing, is that, first of all, you know, we need another perfect example that's going on currently, and I had a little input in it, was poor Dread Eye. Now, Dread Eye hangs around at Food Not Bombs. Now, Food Not Bombs is wonderful in the fact that they serve anyone in any condition. Okay? However, you've got a gathering of intoxicated people, like you do at a bar or a strip joint. Well, at a bar or a strip joint, so that they don't have to be calling the police every time somebody's patronizing their business acts out of line, they use a bouncer in between, you know, as controlling that intoxicated behavior, if you will. Dread Eye does that, and he does it well. He's disarmed people. Yet, there was an altercation that, well, gee, everybody standing around didn't like how he did his bouncer job. So now they fire him, they be done with him because, you know,
I think he was simply put on suspension for a few days.
Yeah, I didn't hear that, and, you know, I had some input in the conversation, never went anywhere, you know, it was like, oh, are you saying he's a cop? No, I'm not saying he's a cop. I mean, I can't think of a better word than bouncer. But what do we want to call it, and how are we going to agree as a group of people that want the best for homeless people until we get out of the situation or not? You know, well, what are we, how are we going to appoint these people? What are we going to call them? And how do we have the same rules of engagement that both pacifists, that like absolutely no violence, and people who are a little more rowdy can agree on?
Yeah.
That's out of the top of your head.
Hey there.
Hi.
How you doing?
Hey, man.
I'm doing great. Oh, hi.
Yeah,
you're fine. I'll come and say hi in a minute.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I'm going to get an update, but let me finish with Kevin's thing. So, Kevin, you're saying that... you also said, in your experience, you have found you've engaged in numerous fights, and they have not been, I don't know how many of them have been lethal, but generally speaking, you're not into the lethal fighting kind of thing.
No, and even, you know, the deadly force used on George Floyd, of course everybody sees that's wrong, you know, and that's, but where people go wrong is, stop it. Thanks. Where people go wrong is with the philosophical fallacy of slippery slope. So now they say, oh, well, if, you know, we don't want people getting choked to death by cops, then, boy, you better not even let two full-grown adults have a good old-fashioned fistfight over an offense that cannot be settled with words. Then the pacifist will tell you that, oh, everything can be settled with words, and if you can't, you just walk away. No, that is not true. If you sexually accost with words my wife in my presence or out of my presence, and I confront you about it, and then you... No, there are certain conversations that they need to stop, and... fists need to be thrown.
Now, you were saying that you yourself have had these experiences recently.
I've had fights just since I've been here, and I've refereed probably another four.
And you said that even the fights that you lost taught you something?
Every fight I've had in here has been nothing more than a brotherly brawl. And it was refereed, and it was, you know, broken up. As soon as somebody tapped out, they were let go. However, technically, by putting somebody in a submission hold that is totally legal by UFC rules, that's a felony. Because when you're blocking an airway and witnesses says, oh, he choked him, and then, yeah, let him go, I'm still committing a felony there.
What was the aftermath of the fights that you, where you were successful and the fights where you yourself submitted? Did you subsequently have a better relationship, no relationship? How did it change?
Thanks for asking that question, Robert. Every fight I've been in, except one I've got going on now, but that's a different category. That's a real gang stalking. That's a real death threat. That's a real personal warfare situation that could easily end in a homicide. Okay? Everything else, all the little brotherly brawls, we hugged with our broken arms, me and Mike. I had a broken arm. He punched me while I had the broken arm. He didn't realize it was just broken. I got him down, and as he went down and I put the choke hold, he broke his arm. He dislocated his shoulder. And yeah, and then 2 days later, we're friends again. And a lot of there was some misunderstandings in that behind it that caused him to punch me. And it, yeah. And then, yeah, and then the other day, you know, I got punished for doing a really good deed. And that's the other thing about the fights. I've talked about them online, but never gave the backstory. And I won't even on this one. You know, there was a backstory where I was doing a good deed and totally in the right. They misunderstood, as I could see where they could misunderstand, and thought I was doing something wrong. Then as I was trying to explain that they were wrong and falsely accusing me, my ire got up and I couldn't keep my volume down, which I've always had a problem with. So now I'm yelling at the guy who's trying to arbitrate, and he wasn't too happy with that, and then ended up punching me in the face. So I shut up, you know, and it kind of ended. It broke up. He actually got me a little dizzy. I almost went out on that one. That still isn't totally settled where we shook hands on it and everything, but I'm not butthurt about it. I'm not going to go to the police about, oh, he assaulted me when I was trying to do a good thing. Or no, it'll be settled. That one will settle out, you know.
I've heard rumors from a confidential source who that there's a regular sort of drug cartel visiting here, dispersing hard drugs. On the other hand, some have said that it's simply a matter of, you know, just sort of a buyer's market where people are buying what they want and what they feel they need. It's not an organized operation. What's your sense of that?
I have very, very little sense about hard drugs and prostitution because I don't do hard drugs and I don't participate in any form of human trafficking. I'm really against it.
Can't sell you anything, huh?
Overlaps, yeah. So yeah, can't answer that question. No, don't know.
And we also have an onlooker. What's your name, ma'am?
This is Leanne Sherwood, author of Around the World on a G-String, and I'm writing a book about this experience. It's going to be called The Perils of Pollyanna.
And what have you learned since we spoke 6 months ago?
Basically, just more evidence that the police are sociopaths. They came last night, night before last, and shined.
Oh, thank you.
Get the goat. Goat's escaping. Thank you. They came and they shined at 10:30 at night. I was already asleep. They woke us up because there's five old ladies in my camp and an old man. And they woke us up at 10:30, shining lights. And my next door neighbor, who's a sweet little old lady, they gave her a ticket for smoking a cigarette. And then when I started calling them out for their abusive behavior, for being domestic terrorists, basically, and calling them out for completely inappropriate behavior, he said that he said I was interfering with an investigation. I said, really? You're investigating an old lady smoking a cigarette? I said, I'm embarrassed for you, you know, just, and then I gave my usual spiel of, you know, the whole world is protesting you, even Baghdad, and they wouldn't be fit to be dog catchers in a civilized country, and that 40% of them self-report domestic violence in America. And
what was the name of the cop?
Oh, he told me. What was that? It wasn't George. It was, I forget what his name was. But there's a couple of them, and I'll go around and get their names before I get the book. But Officer George is one of the worst ones. I caught him shaming some guy for having relapsed, and he said that I was standing there documenting, of course, as I do. He told the guys that he thinks that people in Santa Cruz relapse at a higher rate than other people in the country, and I said that is absolutely not true. And so the next day he got really mad at me because I said I looked it up, and California isn't even on the list of states that have high relapse rates. You know, he got real mad at me, almost got aggressive towards me. And I just stand there and plant my little feet and say, you know, you're embarrassing yourself. You go around telling people, he told the guy he was a social worker for veterans. And I'm like, you don't get to say you're a social worker unless you've done the classes and become a certified social worker. You're not qualified to do that. And so now every time I see him, I'm embarrassed him publicly.
This was the same cop or a different one?
Oh, different one.
His name?
Officer George.
We know his last. That's his last name.
Yeah, that's his last name. Yeah. The guy told me that last night, and then one of them said, "Oh, that's the woman who wrote the book." And he goes, "Oh, that's her." Like he was impressed. Like, "Oh, that's her." And I'm like, "Yeah, it is me." And I tell him.
Waiting to see a copy of your book.
It's a Kindle book, honey.
An e-book, yeah.
It's an e-book.
I don't do Kindle.
Well, it's $300 to publish on Kindle, and it's $20,000 to publish a real book. So, yeah.
Get to it. Come on, you can do it.
Oh, sure. Sure, I'll get right on that.
They self-publish first.
Yeah, so. Right. Well, I hadn't had a chance to.
I want to pass these around if you're interested.
Great, yep. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so anyways, just more shenanigans by the police, you know, just coming through at night, waking us up. Then they flashed the strobe in my tent, you know, because they're kids.
Which camp are you in? Are you in the agreement camp or this camp?
I'm in this camp. I was the first one to come down here because when they said it was time to move, I wanted to set a good example and get everybody down here. And so I got a really good spot where I have only 3 hours of direct sunlight a day, and I'm in the shade most of the time.
And it's mostly been fairly cool this summer?
It's been fairly cool this summer. It's been okay. But we have the water right across. I live right across from the water, so I just go over and dunk my head in the heat. And I've moved three people into my camping space because they needed a safe place. They were down here, and they were being harassed by all the drunks.
How are the showers going? Are there actually showers now?
I guess they're coming on Fridays now.
I have trouble keeping up.
I don't know.
I keep begging for that bulletin board so I could have the schedules for all those things so I could look at it daily. But
Sundays at the warming center, which I've never gone there. I went to Coral Street last week and took a shower.
How was that?
It was fine. It was great. Really nice. They actually had a sink and a mirror in there. That was fabulous. And for the most part, I just fill up my cooler with water, and then I dip a bucket in it and dump over my head, and it feels great. Right out in front of, in a bathing suit out in front of my tent. So, but when it gets cold, I'm actually going to, when I get paid this week, I'm going to get a, there's a $40 self-standing shower from what's the guys, the Big Five?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to get that so that people in my campsite have their an actual shower right on, with a shower bag. And I have a stove, and I heat up water. And when it gets cold, we can take hot showers right in my backyard.
Now, I understand there's some people who were displaying Union of the Homeless signs in the camp. How is that, having any effect? What's your sense of the any kind of union organizing? I know you mentioned, Kevin, that it just seems really hard to get people together in a stable way to agree.
If I was to answer that question, I put this sign out here, and then Jeremy, who I was planning to collaborate with to put in one of those requests for proposals, a request for qualifications for a managed camp, and then he bailed out of it, and he said it was because of me being part of the homeless union, and the homeless union suing the city, and the city writing his paycheck.
It's a conflict of interest, is what he said.
He's no longer.
Yeah. I can see it, but I can't.
They're no longer. They're no longer suing the city. That ended in June.
Yeah, they lifted it. They lifted the restraining order. They've lifted the restraining order, and they're pretty much, other than just the nighttime harassment, and they're actually abiding by the rules and not sweeping people. Because I include everybody who's along the riverbank. I include them as part of our camp because they use our services.
Have you spent much time, or do you know much about the camps that are further on beyond the Dakota Landing camp?
They're just various people who, for one reason or another, maybe people have gotten mad at them and they had to move out of the camp because they pissed somebody off, or they just don't like being in a camp. They like to have privacy. I'd say that's between those two things, that's the motivation for camping along the path down there.
Yes, it's another reason why we need smaller camps, more spread out. It's simple as that, because sometimes people get in a little problem with their neighbors, these misunderstandings where they need to separate for a while.
Yeah, well, science shows that if you put a bunch of rats in close proximity, they get a little testy with each other.
I'm really surprised how well and how peaceful we get along.
Especially in the heat. I think that we've absolutely done a fabulous job of keeping, mostly just yelling and screaming at each other. But as far as the real fights are concerned,
definitely slowed down.
Yeah, and I had somebody, I yelled at him for pushing a girl. So he came over and slashed my tent. That was a while ago. And when Jeremy came through, I told everybody that if anything happened to me, they know who did it, what tent. And Maggie yells out, "Well, there's other people who hate you here." And I said, "Yeah, but there's not other people who admitted it in front of credible witnesses." So he came and apologized a couple days after that. I think they got worried.
Your tents have not been slashed since?
No, my tent. I got a new tent last month, and I gave my old tent because it luckily he slashed it on the side that was already damaged because somebody had shot a they shot a mortar at my tent and blew a hole in one side. So he slashed the side that was already broken. So I gave it to a friend, and he's got a nice shower curtain on that side, and he's got a much bigger tent than he had before. And I have a brand new tent with a porch, and I got some tents for the people behind me. I put three people, two people in my spot and one person in Sandy's spot.
And for those who want to visit you in your tent, is it a secret location, or do you want to announce it?
Yeah, I live right across from the water in the baby blue and black tent. It has a porch, it has a screened-in porch, and then my living area is 94 square feet.
Leanne's one of those that should be on the cover of Better Tents and Gardens, too.
How close to the footbridge is it?
Yes, it's like seven tenths in from the footbridge.
Got you.
Now, one of the largest encampments these days is the camp, former Camp Paradise encampment, which if, I don't know if you've been out there, it just goes on and on forever. It's if you go to the Footbridge Services or Warming Center, very interesting customer here. The goat wants to have a take a bite out of crime, I think. Now he's going
to
take a bite out of the chess set. Well, this set might be a good idea. I don't know. So, Camp Paradise is the area that's under the Highway 1 underpass and then goes on next. It parallels the cemetery. It goes all the way down.
That's at Harvey West.
No, it's not at Harvey West. Oh. It's on the other side of the river.
Oh, okay.
It's on this side of the river.
Oh, okay.
And it's.
Hey!
We're surrounded. These goats are attacking.
Help! Goats are attacking. He's a good boy.
Thank goodness. He's knocked over your pieces. You sure he's not in cahoots with you?
Hi, Manny. I know. Oh, we've got goats trying to eat your chest pieces.
I think we will end this while we deal with the goat emergency. Goats need love and food, too.
I just love you. I love you. You look like a camel with no ears.
Pretty bony, that goat.
He's going to be 200 pounds.
And we've been talking with?
Kevin.
Leanne.
Thanks, Leanne.
Thanks, Kevin. Robert.
Change of thinking sometimes is just...
And before we take our next musical break, just a couple of brief notes from the news. Here's an editorial that I noted in the Chronicle from yesterday. It was from yesterday, in September 1st. Protect protesters from tear gas and bullets. According to this, law enforcement have been using less lethal weapons like tear gas and rubber bullets in more than 100 cities across the country and at least a dozen in California, which have produced many serious, including well over 100 head injuries from projectiles, reports of chemical injuries from tear gas, not to mention the mental health burden, all in the setting of already overburdened hospitals filled with COVID-19 patients. And from L.A. to Oakland, the story continues by Rohina Har and Nick Robinson. Emergency physicians were called on to manage complex facial fractures, groin injuries, and brain traumas. Police were often poorly trained, overly militarized, too aggressive, inappropriately used less lethal weapons. Tear gas and projectiles against crowds often inflamed tensions instead of calming them, leading to confrontation with protesters. In response, lawmakers have started taking action, with at least 6 states and 12 cities already enacting legislation to better regulate those weapons. Some, like Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, have outlawed the use of these weapons to disperse constitutionally protected demonstrations. These bans reinforce current law. But given the indiscriminate nature of firing rubber bullets and tear gas into a crowd, federal courts have repeatedly ruled that it's already unconstitutional to use them to break up a First Amendment-protected protest. For example, in June, a federal district judge issued a preliminary injunction against the L.A. County Sheriff's Department after finding it had indiscriminately targeted peaceful protesters, journalists, and legal observers with tear gas and projectiles. Get out of here. Don't keep watching what we're doing. Just get lost. The challenge for these prohibitions on less lethal weapons, however, is that the Supreme Court has largely failed to lay out clear standards on when a demonstration stops being protected under the First Amendment. If a handful of protesters block a sidewalk, kick over a trash can, or police decide the crowd is, quote, threatening, law enforcement currently has far too broad discretion to declare a protest an unlawful assembly or a riot. And once an unlawful assembly or a riot is declared, in the eyes of the police, bans on less lethal weapons no longer apply. So standards are needed. California is taking the legislative lead, supposedly, in these efforts through AB 48, which passed the Assembly in June and will soon be voted on by the state Senate. It would create new common sense requirements for the use of less lethal weapons for crowd control, including that their use is necessary to prevent serious injury and proportionate to the threat. It also requires that before these weapons are used, there must be a dispersal order by law enforcement and an opportunity to comply. In other words, no kettling. Importantly, after firing less lethal weapons, police would have to publicly justify why their use was necessary and detail why de-escalation tactics were not feasible or failed. These types of reporting requirements are critical to stop the excessive use of these weapons by police. Well, I wish I were as optimistic as Rohini and Nick are in this article. There is no doubt that much more work needs to be done, blah, blah, yada, yada. For now, it's up to states like California. There are measures like AB 48 to lead the way. Actually, these things only happen usually through mass protest. And that's the sad story. You have to get your ass out there to make sure things change, as we saw last year. And then it doesn't even guarantee that. And you get Justin Cummings taking a knee with Andy Mills as your supposed satisfaction and payback, which is no payback at all, but a form of blatant hypocrisy and Uncle Tom posturing. Similarly, writing Black Lives Matter on the sidewalk has nothing to do with making sure that stops against blacks, which are disproportionate, are now logged and examined and essentially eliminated as disproportionate activity anyway. And that's something that Huff has been trying to do for years, not so much because we're wonderfully non-racist. It would be nice if we were. But we are. Our main focus has always been in protecting the rights of poor people, and often poor people happen to also be black, even in the small black community in Santa Cruz. Let's hear a little bit of some music. This article you just heard was an editorial, Protect Protesters from Tear Gas and Rubber Bullets, in the September 1st edition of the San Francisco Chronicle by Rohina Har and Nick Robinson.
This month of the year, on the 1st of May, known around the world as International Workers' Day, you'll still see people marching in every corner of the earth. St. John to Santiago, Kerala to Perth, all keeping alive the fantasy what could happen down the line. When the workers of the world combine. You can see us gathering early in the morn. Some are celebrating the shackles we have shorn, while so many billions are just waiting for the moment that we might stop losing the class war. But someday we can all say, yeah, we're doing fine. Of the world combined. When that time arrives, maybe it looks like mating, like a festival that comes home and doesn't go away. Every race and gender, every walk and station, with the working class united, every land and nation. Then just watch what happens when we follow the same sign. When the workers of the world combine. Fifth month of the year, on the 1st of May, known around the world as International Workers' Day.
And here's a little more from Goatman Kevin, kind of to finish off this rather interesting discussion that we've had, and here it is. Continuing this discussion of how to deal with problems that arise in the camp so that you have your own standard of conduct, you're saying that it becomes difficult when someone who is like a city employee like Jeremy tries to
intervenes. He might be regarded as interference. He probably is interference. He files a court case against something that was a physical exchange, but it was something essentially agreed to by the people involved.
Right.
Yes and no, but it's got to be consistent. We can't beat up that pedophile.
Right, and
that
not
we're
beat
kicking
the
out
pedophile.
And not, yeah.
Right.
If we're going to accept certain amounts of minor violence as
right.
a way of keeping the peace
right.
without involving the police
yes.
over every single thing,
yes.
you know,
I agree.
Then we have to do it consistently.
Yes.
It's not fair to Driftwood that
right.
he gets in trouble
right.
and gets
right.
a case out of it, but you don't.
Right.
And another thing
exactly.
I'll say,
yeah.
and I'll say this in front of you, Leanne,
sure.
if we know each other's politics here,
yeah.
A person like Jeremy has an extreme bias towards females, and that's not fair either.
No, it isn't.
You know,
you're right. I totally agree with you. Yeah, that we should all have the same standard.
Exactly.
And, you know, even little old ladies like me, if I have to keep the peace and use a stick to do it, if, you know, I think that they should just leave it.
The devil with the curtain rod?
No, they're calling me Gangster Barbie.
Gangster Barbie.
But some guy, a guy that I knew, he robbed me of $100, and one of the other guys, kind of the tough guy, said that he knew where he was going to hang out, so we went and talked to him, told him he had 3 days to pay me back, or else, and he didn't say what or else. So when he didn't, I said, so what's the or else? And he goes, I'm going to go talk to his father. So, you know, that was good, too. I'll probably never get the money back, but at least he had a consequence
exactly.
that his family will know he robbed an old lady.
Yeah.
You know, so, hey. But as far as an older man giving a 14-year-old his phone number and offering to get her high if she calls him,
yeah.
luckily she went straight to her mother, and those of us who are in her family ran him out of camp, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like Jasper, who twice, you know, there's a perfect... not hypothetical example of somebody doing something, exposing himself
right.
yeah, to another man, not a kid, but still.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Now I have a right, I think, to fight with that guy. That's not a, you know.
If he did it to me, I'd knock the shit out of him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Should have a right. But
yeah.
technically, they'll say you're both in the wrong. Now, you're
right.
guilty of assault, and
yeah.
you're guilty of indecent
yeah.
exposure.
Yeah,
now let's get witnesses. Now let's... Why?
But if anything
why?
Happens and we call the police, they never do anything. When Shay spit on one of the guys who were singing on the Saturday church players over there, she spit on him and hit him. And so he called the police, and when the police came, Officer Townsend told him that he can't do anything about it. He says, "Well, if you're there," they said, "Oh, the police said they will. If they find her, they'll give her a citation." And he goes, "So the next week, if she does that again, I just have to deal with it myself." And then I spoke up and said, "And then Officer Townsend will arrest you because they want us to beat each other up. They want us to kill each other. They won't give us any help." And it happened to me one day when and after that. And because I was liaising for them and the police, and he's like, "I can't believe it." I said, "Yeah, you know, after we beat them in court, they're just whiny little babies, and they're just doing these petty little vindictive by not protecting us. They won't protect us. They won't do anything about it." And so then she went down and lit both porta potties on fire. This is Shay. Lit the porta potties on fire, and then chased me the length of the camp. And they said, "We'll give her a citation if we see her," because she's hiding in somebody's tent, right? One of her fellow meth heads hides her, you know. And so, you know, they won't protect us. Even if we do report it, they won't do anything to protect us. And now Shay is dead, so we don't have that as an issue
overdose?
Anymore. Yeah, she, yeah.
How many people have died of overdoses? And do you want to mention them as by name so
yeah.
that you can remember them?
Yeah, Ashanti, who was a friend of mine, and look at you, and Shay, and these are the people, Chief. These are the ones who died by me that I watched them take their bodies away. But those are the only ones that I know about, but I know there's a lot more.
Fair enough. And we've been talking to...
Leanne Sherwood.
Of course. And here are a few more articles that caught my attention. Here's one from the Chronicle from August 24th. Officers shot, kills bystander.
Police officer in Guadalupe, Santa Barbara County, accidentally killed a bystander sitting in a car while shooting at a suspect over the weekend, authorities said. The shooting occurred Saturday night, the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office said in a statement. Police officers recognized a person at an intersection as a suspect with an outstanding felony arrest warrant, the statement said. Killed when the officer opened fire was Juan Luis Olivera Preciado, 59. The felony suspect was arrested. We aren't being told what the felony was, of course. Police Chief Michael Cash asked the sheriff's office to conduct a probe, but detectives said the incident fell under a state law that requires the attorney general to investigate incidents of officer-involved shootings that result in the death of an unarmed civilian. So it'll be the attorney general that covers it up rather than the local. Am I being a bit too cynical? Cash, however, met personally with Olivera Preciado family to offer his condolences, the statement said. Death after restraint ruled accidental. That's the August 23rd Chronicle. Family of Antioch Navy veteran disappointed by Contra Costa jury's ruling absolving police. A jury has ruled the death of Angelo Quinto an accident after a three-hour hearing in which three police officers described the December 2020 night they restrained the 30-year-old Antioch man for several minutes until he lost consciousness. That's quite a restraint, apparently. But Friday's ruling isn't binding and won't affect a separate criminal investigation into what happened the night Quinto's family members say police went too far. The Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office holds coroner's inquests for every person who dies in police custody. The coroner, however, falls under the sheriff's purview. Friday's inquest, which took place at the county courthouse in Martinez, offered a window into an incident now framed by two starkly different narratives, the one from law enforcement that drug use created the conditions for Quinto's death, and the one from Quinto's family that he was asphyxiated when officers knelt on him and held him to the floor. These two versions became more complicated when forensic pathologists like Akichi Ogun, who contracts with the coroner's office, it's my job, released the county's autopsy reports. He testified that Quinto had tested positive for two prescription drugs, a medication used to treat seizures, and a stimulant often used for narcolepsy, though people also take the latter recreationally. My, so it's all in the fault of the drugs, eh? The cause of death, Ogun said, was excited delirium syndrome due to acute drug toxicity with disturbances and by physical exertion. Excited delirium, a term loosely defined as sudden aggressive paranoid behavior, has drawn skepticism from doctors and psychiatrists. In a statement published this year, the AMA, American Medical Association, rejected excited delirium as a medical diagnosis, noting that law enforcement use it to rationalize excessive force and to disproportionately apply the syndrome to black men who would die in police custody. Oakland attorney John Burris, who represents Quinto's family in a federal lawsuit against Antioch, its police chief, and the four officers involved in a deadly encounter, called the diagnosis a form of debunked science. Burris's fellow attorney, Benjamin Neisenbaum, was so disgusted by Ogan's testimony that he burst out laughing in the packed courtroom and walked out to avoid the ire of hearing officer Matthew Guilchard. The hearing officer later scolded the court audience, saying he saw the interruption as an attempt to influence jurors. Friday's proceeding followed months of outcry and an accelerated push for police reform in Antioch, all stemming from a frantic phone call made by Quinto's sister Bella Collins on the night of December 23rd. She said her brother was acting aggressive and she feared he would hurt her mother, Cassandra Quinto Collins. When police arrived, they found Quinto and his mother on the floor of Quinto Collins' bedroom. In an embrace that Officer Arturo Becerra and retired Officer James Perkinson described as a bear hug. They testified that they pulled the two apart, handcuffed Quinto, and held him on the floor for at least 5 minutes using a figure-four restraint to lock his right leg to his left. Because Antioch police had no body cameras at that time, the only visual recording of the incident is a wobbly cell phone video taken by Quinto Collins, which Guichard presented in court Friday. It shows officers rolling Kinto over, revealing a smear of blood in his mouth. He died at the Sutter Delta Medical Center 3 days later, though police took nearly a month to disclose the death. Kinto had served in the Navy but was discharged for a medical condition. He later began showing signs of schizoaffective disorder and was detained on a 72-hour psychiatric hold last October, 2 months before he died. Neighbors had called police to report he was behaving erratically, apparently locking himself out of the family home on Crestwood Drive. Officers said they had called an ambulance on December 23rd to place Kinto on a hold again, that they held his legs and briefly pressed his shoulders, avoiding his neck. He kept saying, "Don't kill me, don't kill me," Perkinson testified. He was saying that before we actually touched him. After hearing the testimony from six witnesses, the forensic pathologist, three officers, a detective, and an investigator from the Contra Costa County DA's office, the jury of 15 people took less than half an hour to reach its verdict of accidental death. It had three other options: homicide, suicide, or death from natural causes. The jury's decision will have no bearing on a separate criminal investigation by the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office, said a spokesperson. DA Deanna Becton attended the hearing with at least one investigator. Burris Nisenbaum and Kinto's family members held a news conference on the steps of the courthouse after the inquest. They said they were not surprised by the ruling and that, if anything, the officer's testimony Friday would become ammunition for their civil lawsuit. "We expected this," Kinto's stepfather Robert Collins said of the verdict, adding that he is still disappointed. He had spent much of the hearing comforting his wife, Kinto Collins, who alternately sobbed and shook her head. Arguing that the evidence and testimony that day was designed to shame Angelo Kinto and his family, attorney Burris said the outcome would have been different if the sheriff had invited Kinto's mother and sister to take the stand. He said the family's position has not changed. Its lawsuit accuses the Antioch police of desperately seeking alternative explanations for Kinto's death to cover up what Burris called a malicious and unreasonable use of force. And that's death after restraint ruled accidental by Rachel Swan, August 23rd, last month's newspaper.
This machine is dangerous. It communicates. It can carry memes that can destabilize a state. It can carry rumors, whether true or not. It can sow discord like an agent or a bot. It can bring people together. It can unify. Or it can spread half-truths and lies. This machine is dangerous. It can light a fire. There may be no limit to what it can inspire. Bring a person to the edge of sanity and back. It can mobilize a mob to attack. It can fire ammunition with each swing of a pick, faster than Jackie Chan can kick. This machine is dangerous. It's locked and loaded. Each string is a grenade that hasn't yet exploded, because it exists here in the world, on the net, whether it's on Twitch or on your TV set. With words, ideas can spread, each one a potential bullet in the head. This machine is dangerous. It can make you dance. It can make you feel like maybe you have a chance. It can sell a brand of ketchup. It can save your soul. It can create division, if division is the goal. It can build a movement, or it can call it out. Of one thing at least, there is no doubt. This machine is dangerous.
And that was another one by David Rovix called This Machine. The previous one, in case I didn't tell you, is No War But Class War. And the one before that was As the Planet Floods and Burns. I think I may have mentioned that. I'm not sure. A lot of these songs, in fact, all these songs are online. And David does this hoping that you will appreciate what he does and contribute to it. Now let's catch what has become a fairly common addition to the show, Keith McHenry and his latest on the Union of the Homeless and Food Not Bombs.
The line with that man about Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry. It's around 7:30 on August 31st, and I guess you're planning for a September 1st, Uzi Wetz's Hallapalooza going through town with the Freedom Riders tomorrow?
Yeah, so what we have is California's Homeless Rising, and that starts at noon at Laurel and Front Street with the band Johnny and the Delta Variants.
Mm-hmm.
And an art show. And so that's happening. I'm very excited about that. And then the caravan will arrive, and there'll be a few kind words about the wonderful the people living outside are treated by governments throughout the state, and then explaining the trip towards Sacramento for the weekend, and where there will be a gathering of locals, hopefully from all over the state, although, boy, it is tough. No one has money, no one has driver's licenses, no one has vehicles. It's a raggedy situation, but somebody's got to do it.
So where are these vehicles who are coming into Santa Cruz tomorrow coming from?
I think they're coming from Sausalito, yeah.
Oh, really? So they're not coming from Southern California?
I mean, well, yeah, they've been coming for days from Southern California, but they today they're in Sacramento. I mean, in Salinas, rather, is where they are.
So, Sausalito, they aren't going to go down to Santa Cruz and then back up to Sacramento from Sausalito.
I'm sorry. So they're with West down in his union, and then Salinas, and then they'll be up here. And I think they did some stuff at Watsonville today. So they did Salinas, Watsonville today.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming in to here in the Santa Cruz tomorrow. And then they were going to go. It's unclear whether they're going to Novato first or to the Sausalito to the boat people trip or someplace in Oakland. This we do not know. But that will be determined tomorrow.
Now, will you be going with them to Sacramento?
I'm going to go to Sacramento on the weekend. I'm not going to go, tomorrow or the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I will do that.
So, regarding the more local scene, today was a special study session of the shitty council in Santa Cruz.
Can we, I need to get back to you. Can you call me right back?
Sure, I can try that.
Thank you. Okay, cool.
All right, well, welcome back. Yeah, the issue that the conservative, one might even say, reactionary majority on the city council, in my view, tends to apparently want to cement into place is its continued electoral victories, which I think it intends to do by establishing district elections. Do you have any thoughts on that one, Keith?
Liberals did that in San Francisco. It was kind of, a fiasco at the beginning. It took a long time before progressives could get any more seats as a result. So, but I don't really know that much about that thing. It does seem like Santa Cruz is so little, it seems stupid to have districts. But I also heard a rumor that Ryan Coonerty is trying to become the city manager. That's, weird.
Really? Because I thought it was it the former water director, Rene?
Rene is the interim city manager currently.
Mm-hmm. I got you.
And they're still doing the national search, and for some reason Coonerty is trying to really bully his way into that position,
mm-hmm.
which would be really a disaster, although I'm sure it'll be a disaster no matter what happens.
Now, I've gotten some reports from folks who are using the Food Not Bombs meal, folks who are serving there, some rather gloomy estimates of how things are going. at the daily chow down. What's your sense of this? I know you tend to do an upbeat approach to the whole thing, but realistically speaking, are there problems currently with the Food Now Bombs meal? Do they need to be addressed? What's your sense?
There's always lots of logistical problems and different crises that are the nature of such a thing. So currently, apparently, there's a man with a huge problems on his leg, and we've been trying to with both his legs, and there's this kind of weird trip amongst a few people that they think they're going to catch whatever he has. So we got him a tent and put him in away from where the food is, and then we've been calling the Homeless Persons Healthcare Project. He's refusing ambulance. We're trying to get a doctor there. There's another woman who has probably some kind of a pest that's eating her alive on top of her having a mental health issue that's sort of aggravating that. And so she's actually scratched all her hair off her head, which has taken about a month for her to do. And actually now that she has no hair on her head, it looks like she's sort of healing because whatever the pest was, which might be lice or who knows. And she just sleeps in the ground right there. You know, she doesn't go anywhere. She's just there 24 hours a day, and she just lays down wherever she happens to be. But I have to say, once she scratched all her hair off, she's become much more communicative the last couple of days. I've never actually had a coherent conversation with her. Her name's Penny. For ever until like yesterday. So there's that. We've quelled the violence. Has gone way down. We've made a couple of arrangements, some changes in staffing and stuff, and that has completely. That part has been much more mellow. We had issues with the accidental removal of the dumpster by the city, so there was like a 3 or 4 days that were brutal, where I had to pick everything up and put it in garbage bags and then put it out by the curb, and that was stressful. And we had a couple of drivers who had issues with, like, their roommates tested positive for COVID, so they had to wait for their test so they could drive, so there's bumps and the driver's thing. There's nothing unusual, actually. I mean, it's just a different array of issues.
Is there much apprehension with the growing tendency of authorities, I think in Santa Cruz as well, to demand either vaccination or weekly COVID testing? Right now, I guess they're only looking for that in county employees, but as you know, in San Francisco, it's becoming likely, I don't know if it's even mandated yet, that to go into numerous public places, they're going to be requiring evidence of vaccination. What's the feeling among the unvaccinated among homeless folks, and is that a fairly large percentage?
Oh, I have no idea, really, who's been or not been vaccinated, or if there's even any way to prove, even if you were vaccinated, to prove it. I mean, who's going to be able to do that? And, because no one has a cell phone, there's no way that whatever their card was is long gone by now. And but so far, I mean, the places that people would want to go, people who live outside would never want to, I mean, they'd love to go there if they had money, but there's no, the only things I ever hear about are like concerts that are on the radio. I don't see any particular thing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Only place I've ever actually seen a thing was at the vet's hall today. There was a sign saying you had to do something on there on this sign, and then that would like trigger something that would identify you as a vaccinated person. But I don't know anything about that. And,
Well, speaking of the Vets Hall, I've heard from a couple of people who lived there formerly that everyone was either able to go into a group shelter, which is problematic, into a room key situation, or actually into some kind of housing, or else decided they wanted to go out onto their own. Have you gotten any, because I understand that the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz closed down, what, a month or two ago, right?
Yeah, a month ago, those people all moved over to 7th Avenue at the, whatever that is, and I don't know how, which is being run by the Association of Faith Communities, you know, the VFW hall over there. So that's where a lot of those people went to. There had been this big hullabaloo of trying to get a better, you know, having tiny houses that people would move into, but no land was ever able to be secured yet, so that's where they're having their trouble.
Showers in the benchlands.
I did hear today from people up at the Golf Links place next to the Armory. It will be shut down on the 15th of September. So,
How many people will that displace?
I think that's like 60 tents. I don't know how many people are in them.
What about showers in the benchlands? Have you heard that they're showing up on one day?
I have not heard any solid information about that. I mean, I have an assumption that that's happening, but I don't know for sure.
Because I know that's been one of the concerns that the Union of the Homeless, which you're still meeting every Friday at 5, right?
Yeah, Friday at 5 at the Honda Courthouse. And we are making some pretty good headway. We've got like a paper version and an online version of this of a pledge that took us a while to organize. We're also just handed out flyers at all the hotels encouraging people, you know, the headline of it is a housing voucher is not housing. And then it encourages people to make sure that they don't leave unless they're guaranteed an indoor location to go to. Mm-hmm. And it reinforces the idea that a housing voucher is not housing. There's more text on there about that. And then it encourages you to call Dr. Rettner at Housing for Health to make sure you do get in the housing, that your housing voucher actually leads you into a place.
Now, I've heard that people...
We have that out of let's see, we did the Oceana, we did the Salt Air, we did the Fireside, so we're systematically handing out these flyers in each hotel so you do not have to leave because of Martin V. Boyce.
How many people are in each of the motels, would you estimate?
Oh, wow, I don't know. My understanding is this roughly 200 people are being evicted on September 3rd.
That's coming right up, and I know that there was a district court has ruled overturning Biden's help 80%, dump 20% don't help them with rent, but at least stall the evictions, and that executive order is now in doubt. Have you had seen any local implications of this?
Not directly, but we will. So, yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that the CDC eviction moratorium was over. Now, Goldman Sachs is reporting that they believe over 750,000 homes will foreclose or evictions will happen. That's probably that might be really accurate, although there are predictions of as many as 6-8 million in this wave.
That's nationwide, right?
Nationwide, yeah. And then there's random things going on. So, for instance, the other thing is it turns out that of the $47 billion in rent and subsidies, that it's not even, I think they're saying it's only in the area of about, well, this is being generous, but less than $5 billion of the total amount has gone out. And there's even New York Times and Post, Washington Post and stuff like that are, for this news report, because tomorrow is also the first day that Houston Food Help Office might be arrested under a ordinance that was came about in 2012 that's been in federal court. And I think there's been a couple of rulings that adversely affect both Food Help Office's right to serve food. So they're organizing a campaign to risk rest tomorrow. And they share food like 3 or 4 times a week. And then, of course, they're already getting refugees from the hurricane, which is typical for these hurricanes in Louisiana, that a lot of people go over to Houston to get out of the way.
And if it isn't just hurricanes, we have, of course, the eviction threat. Here's a story from the August 29th Chronicle again. Eviction anxiety intensifies after high court ruling, by Alan Rappaport, Sophie Kasikov, and Connor Dougherty. Millions of Americans around the country face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court last week rejected the Biden administration's latest federal moratorium on evictions. Court's ruling Thursday has once again thrust Biden into the middle of a fight to help prevent people from being evicted as the Delta variant of the coronavirus surges and as Democrats remain unable to muster enough votes to pass a new ban on evictions, or unwilling, because they don't seem to be terribly excited about it. And neither does Biden, for that matter. He needs to be dragged kicking and screaming into this. With no legal avenues remaining to take action on its own, the Biden administration issued a plea to state and local officials to do more to help. That's what we call passing the buck. In a letter, top cabinet members urged governors, mayors, county executives, and judges and administrators to extend local eviction moratoriums. And that hasn't happened here locally. I think the state has extended its moratorium, I believe, through September 30th. The letter from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, Marcia Fudge, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Attorney General Merrick Garland also asked them to, please, 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 enact policies that would require landlords to apply for federal aid before enforcing evictions, and recommended that evictions be delayed while rental aid applications were pending. Supreme Court ruling divided lawmakers. The Supreme Court's ruling divided lawmakers along party lines, with Republicans applauding the decision and the Democrats demanding legislative action, but apparently not bothering to stay in session to address the looming eviction crisis. A group of progressive House Democrats wrote a letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, calling on congressional leaders to include an extended moratorium that would last through the end of the pandemic in upcoming legislation. An effort by House Democrats to extend the eviction ban failed in July. Jan Psaki, White House press secretary, said Friday that Biden would welcome congressional action. Barring that, she said the White House was focused on finding other ways to ease the burden on renters by encouraging the delay of evictions and getting financial assistance out the door more quickly. That's been another very serious problem. People are not getting the aid they're supposed to be getting. The effect on tenants will vary tremendously from state to state, yada, yada, yada. In California, renters are shielded from eviction through September 30th under a state law signed by Governor Newsom in June. And now let's hear a little bit from David Rovics.
Bombing Baghdad, there's a famine in Tigray. Fires are burning in Flagstaff, blocking out the day. The wind blows so fiercely, the grass is turning brown, and it's 116 degrees in Portland town. The spas and churches dripping with blood. A tower collapsed in Miami, damaged from the flood. Before the summer's over, who knows how many will drown, and it's 116 degrees in Portland town. The price masses of houses are rising like never before, along with ocean waters as the temperatures soar. The developers develop, water tables go down, and it's 116 degrees in Portland town. In the Congress, they're discussing infrastructure. Whether it should be built to withstand fire, they're not sure. They found a dead man in an RV wearing a thorny crown, and it's 116 degrees in Portland town. Outside a motel, a man was flipping out. He called 911 to tell them about need for mental health care, so they came and shot him down, and it's 116 degrees in Portland town. Don't know where we're going, what kind of shit's in store. I know I'm not the first to feel like I'm knocking on the door of either a new dystopia or some movement of great renown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. In the farms in the valley, they're out picking cherries, dropping dead on the field with a basket full of berries. City of bridges, each one like a frown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. No way out, even north of the border. Welcome to the new world order. Produced by criminal corporate clowns. It's 116 degrees in Portland town.
And that one I think I have played before, but not too recently. It's called 116 Degrees. Now back to Keith McHenry.
And that's what happened with Katrina. And tomorrow is also the first day that Houston food operators might be arrested under a ordinance that was came about in 2012 that's been in federal court, and I think there's been a couple of rulings that adversely affect both Food on Bombs' right to serve food, so they're organizing a campaign to risk rest tomorrow, and they share food like 3 or 4 times a week, and then of course they're already getting refugees from the hurricane, which is typical. These hurricanes in Louisiana that a lot of people go over to Houston to get out of the way. And that's what happened with Katrina. And
now in Katrina, I understand Food Now Bombs played an important role in providing emergency services. Is this also happening with this latest hurricane?
There is a discussion in the Food Now Bombs community. I know like Tampa Food Now Bombs is organizing stuff. I don't know all the extent of it, but it just happened, so it's not clear what's going to go on. But we have been putting things on our social media, encouraging support, and the website from Katrina to give ideas of what potentially you can do. Mm-hmm. That was a success. Well, we were the main food for 8 months in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and after Katrina, it was total failure of FEMA.
Any reports from other encampments in Santa Cruz, like Dakota Landing or Camp Paradise or Miri Lagoon?
There's a massive amount of towing of RVs, and they're advertising. They're actually running these bridges, you can visibly see people without tents, and we start getting people asking for tents at the meal, who are sleeping in the, it was like, you know, the redwood trees that by the post office annex, the back of it, and the meeting strip, there's no people just sleeping there. There are people sleeping along Cedar Street next to the, you know, the Walnut Street garage and those little, you know, grassy areas between trees. There are people, there was like four or five people sleeping at the town clock. There were people on Civic. There were people, you know, and it wasn't unusual that they're all people just in blankets and sleeping bags, which is somewhat of an indication their situation has just changed. And I'm down there a lot, so, and I had not seen that, probably about 30 people at all.
Did you notice many people on the medians? When I was driving through today, I saw virtually nobody on the Ocean Street or Water Street medians, where there usually are folks signing and so forth, or on the Highway 1, Highway 9 medians. Have you been any observations on that?
No, I keep seeing a lot of my same people at the different intersections. So it's normal. Hmm. They might have just gone, you know, it's just why that happened. That seems normal.
Could be an ebb and flow, yeah.
They had to go to the bathroom, or they went to go eat from their proceeds, or whatever was going on.
So, anything new on the Chico and Novato lawsuits? Are they still in force protecting homeless people in those towns, or have they been vacated like in Sausalito and Santa Cruz?
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. And we've been, you know, we're just like, so our kind of thing is that, yeah, we're trying to get another parking lot place on a church parking lot somewhere to put another shipping container. Because we're like stockpiling rice and beans and stuff for, so if there's a glitch in the system, which is highly likely, that we will be able to bridge between, whatever goes on with that. So we're trying to gear up for that. And I don't know what the deal will be with the, currently there's a state eviction moratorium, although they're in the recent polling, they said that, got one of the highest numbers of total, they have like some kind of, Fannie Mae or something, but of a number of people that believe that they're going to be evicted or foreclosed on. Very high in California, a couple million people total that reported that they were likely or very likely to be evicted in the next 2 months.
Any new lawsuits that have been implemented either by Prince or by other allied organizations to defend the right to shelter in place, whether in Santa Cruz, as you've been endlessly talking about how you've been preparing and working for it and gathering information, and I've sort of, gone to sleep with this litany, which I hear from you endlessly. I'm wondering, is it happening in any other places?
No, but here's where we're getting to a breaking point here. I think we're going to make some moves. So anyway, it turns out Sea Otter has been getting camping tickets as well as trespass tickets. So I'm going to get his record, and he's happy to be a plaintiff. And that proves that they're violating Martin v. Boise, so that's one thing. And hopefully this eviction trip of the hotels into nowhere land will also inspire some more action.
Not to mention the Delta variant.
The Delta variant, and then what's the new one they're getting up? Even better than the Delta.
I heard something about it. Don't know what it's called.
Lambda. It's going to be nicer. Gamma or Lambda.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I think they're going to keep getting these early. They should get more and more interesting. The variants as more and more people,
Are you hearing of increased illness among folks outside or not?
Not people on the streets, no. I mean, if you live outside, it seems like you don't really have So there was, let's see, the only person so far that I know that kind of generally lives outside at the city place up by the armory, Bowflex. And he, that was Dreamcatcher got COVID. He seems fine now, but he seemed a bit sick for a while. And then Crystal got COVID working at the events hall as the night.
How's she doing?
She's fine. Her COVID only lasted like 2 days, 3 days. The symptom, of course, symptoms of it.
Now, of course, the most important question. How many goats will be going to Sacramento?
I don't think we're taking any of Kevin's goats. I don't know. And we haven't even organized how all this is going to go on. It's like kind of great. There's so many complications. It's insanity. But anyway, we're trudging along, and we're trying to build solidarity with, Democratic Socialists and other kinds of groups like that. Seems like we're trying to get a larger coalition.
I know you had a series.
We're also trying to get churches that we're kind of harassing churches for not really being real.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping that we're really on the kind of a rampage around that, in part because of us paying $4,000 a month to the Episcopal Church, and it, highlighting the fact that other than them letting us give them $4,000 a month, there's actually almost nothing going on with churches helping, the crisis.
Do you know how much the Association of Faith Communities is getting from either the state or the county or the feds, for that matter, for supposedly providing homeless shelter or van space?
I have no idea what they get. I know that they have internal conflicts that are quite difficult. And, for instance, there's a lot of animosity toward the people running the safe parking. Now, they've been kind of put, it's like this thing where you negotiate, they made a mistake, or that they have to because they own properties and there's nothing they can do about it. But they negotiated the safe parking law, which is unattainable by most people. But even some people who are fully registered, like Alicia, and who are fully, everything, she could pass the background check, all those things, they still told them that they weren't going to let her safe parking place. And there's kids, all that, an RV, but it meets the RV standard, but we can't do it in a car. So the whole bit is she's registered and blah, blah, blah. So they just told her, screw off, And so that pastor, like a bunch of other people, are all angry at that pastor because he just basically tells people to get lost.
And who is this?
I forget the guy's name. It's like some Pastor Joseph or something like that. And so then there's that. Essentially, it seems like there's a relatively small number of people in that community who actually get the people that live outside are actually real humans with agency and dignity and that. They don't get that. They're really stuck on this bunch of mellow, drug addicts, alcoholics. And that's a huge stumbling block with they're well-meaning. They're like, we want to help these poor, unfortunate people. And that attitude is exactly why they basically, essentially, keep screwing the homeless and almost every one of their programs. At least with the shower. It's a shower. It's not that much, problem with it. But the safe parking is a complete disaster. What's really frightening is all these news articles and stuff keep, saying, in the one that was horrible, they were like, this person had 67 unpaid tickets, never mentioning the fact that, that the cops come there every hour and give them a ticket. It doesn't take that long to, I guess, every 72 hours. And then they couldn't move their vehicles. So they lost everything. And over and over again, like that. And, you know, because they're aggressively ticketing RVs so that they can tow. But they give this impression that these are these horrible people that just refuse to pay thousands of dollars worth of tickets. That's just outrageous. And that they could go to safe parking. You know, I emailed one of the reporters about this and never get back, you know. It's run this propaganda. And it is, and then the police department also posted this thing about towing. They've done at least two Facebook posts recently hailing their towing of RVs. And then one of them, they added a story about a heroin bust. The same story, so you could, you know, even though it was just a disabled guy who couldn't pay his parking tickets, they try to mush it in with a heroin bust and give the impression that somehow people living in RVs are selling heroin or something. And it's really cruel. And, you know, it just makes me think, you know, when I see all this, like, orchestrated stuff of Andy Mills, and Andy Mills is supposed to be this great Christian wearing his little Jesus thing around his wrist and everything.
Andy Mills is the police chief, right?
Police chief, yeah. And then, I mean, that's about as unchristian as humanly possible, putting people out of their vehicles into doorways. I mean, what could be more cruel? And mostly elderly people. It's just outrageous that is the case. So.
Now, Huff has been concerned recently that some of its members have been hauled away under 5150s or else simply bullied into accepting so-called treatment by psychiatric authorities who, while they don't force people to take medication in Santa Cruz, ship them off to San Jose and Sacramento, where you are, according to the accounts of two individuals who are Huff members and who suffered this recently, forced to medicate without benefit of rehearing or, you know, more reasonable, less injurious alternatives and so forth. Have you had much call for or awareness of or complaints about this kind of thing happening in Santa Cruz among your patrons at the Food Now Bombs?
No, nothing like that, man. Which is, I mean, people disappear, but we don't know where they disappear to. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, some could have disappeared off to mental hospitals. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, it looks like, you know, Portuguese Tony, he's been gone for like a couple of months. He probably is in jail. I don't know, you know, but I am very concerned about this idea that you're, like, I remember hearing several people a couple of years ago being offered housing if they would take Prozac or Zoloft or something, and they just weren't interested in doing that, which mm-hmm. is totally understandable, and then they just didn't get the housing.
Any reports from jail in the Santa Cruz County Jail about conditions there?
No, I haven't heard anybody get out recently and say anything. No. I should probably go because Kathleen made it home and I haven't seen her all day.
Well, you'll be, by the time we play this, it will have already happened. But if people want more information about Food Not Bombs, their best bet is...
They're going to foodnotbombs.net or calling 1-800-884-1136.
And now to end the show on a somewhat grim note, here is an article by Karen Gallardo, What the Seven Stages of COVID Look Like from the Front Lines. She's a respiratory therapist at Community Memorial Hospital in Ventura. I'm a respiratory therapist. With the fourth wave of the pandemic in full swing, fueled by the highly contagious Delta variant, the trajectory of the patients I see from admission to critical care is all too familiar. When they're vaccinated, their COVID-19 infections most likely end after stage one. If only that were the case for everyone. Get vaccinated. If you choose not to, here's what to expect if you're hospitalized for a serious case of COVID-19. Stage 1. You've had debilitating symptoms for a few days, but now it is so hard to breathe that you come to the emergency room. Your oxygen saturation level tells you that you need help.
a supplemental flow of 1 to 4 liters of oxygen per minute. We start you on antivirals, steroids, anticoagulants, or monoclonal antibodies. You'll spend several days in the hospital feeling run down, but if we can wean you off the oxygen, you'll get discharged. Stage 2. It is becoming harder for you to breathe. Like drowning is how many patients describe the feeling. The bronchodilator treatments we give you provide little relief. Your oxygen requirements increase significantly from 4 liters to 15 liters to 40 liters per minute. Little things like relieving yourself or sitting up in bed become too difficult for you to do on your own. Your oxygen saturation rapidly declines when you move about. We transfer you to the intensive care unit. Stage 3. You're exhausted from hyperventilating. We put you on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, a big, bulky face mask that must be Velcroed tightly around your face so the machine can efficiently push pressure into your lungs to pop them open enough so you get enough of the oxygen it delivers. Stage 4. Your breathing becomes even more labored. An arterial blood draw confirms that the oxygen content in your blood is critically low. We prepare to intubate you. If you're able to and if there's time, we will suggest that you call your loved ones. This might be the last time they'll hear your voice. We connect you to a ventilator. You are sedated and paralyzed, fed through a feeding tube, hooked to a Foley catheter and a rectal tube. We turn your limp body regularly so you don't develop pressure ulcers. We bathe you and keep you clean. We flip you onto your stomach to allow for better oxygenation. We will try experimental therapeutics. Stage 5. Some patients survive stage 4. Unfortunately, your oxygen levels and conditions have not improved. Your COVID-19 infected lungs need assistance and time to heal, something that an ECMO machine, which bypasses your lungs and oxygenates your blood, can provide. But, alas, our community hospital doesn't have that capability. If you're stable enough, you will get transferred to another hospital for that therapy. Otherwise, we'll continue treating you as best we can. We're understaffed and overwhelmed, but we'll always give you the best care we can. Stage 6. The pressure required to open your lungs is so high that air can leak into your chest cavity, so we insert tubes to clear it out. Your kidneys fail to filter the byproducts from the drugs. Despite diuretics, your entire body swells from fluid retention, and you require dialysis to help for your renal retention, for your renal function. The long hospital stay and your depressed immune system makes you susceptible to infections. A chest x-ray shows fluid accumulating in your lung sacs. A blood clot may show up too. We can't prevent these complications at this point. We treat them as they present. If your blood pressure drops critically, we will administer vasopressors to bring it up, but your heart may stop anyway. After several rounds of CPR, we'll get your pulse and circulation back, but soon your family will need to make a difficult decision. Stage 7. After several meetings with your palliative care team, your family decides to withdraw care. We extubate you, turning off the breathing machine. We set up a final FaceTime call with your loved ones. As we work in your room, we hear crying and goodbyes.
We cry. And we hold your hand until your last breath.
I've been at this 17 months now. It doesn't get easier. My pandemic stories rarely end well. And that's a respiratory therapist's view of what the 7 stages of COVID look like from the front lines by Karen Galato. And it was reprinted in the Mercury News of August 31st. Let's go out on a song by David Rovix. This song is called After Friday Prayers. And if you have any comments or thoughts or want to be interviewed yourself on issues that we brought up here or you think that we should have brought up here, give me a call at 831-423-4833. That's the line for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And it's also a contact point for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.